Hi, it's Nick here. Thanks so much for your continued support of this daily podcast, which marches relentlessly towards 1,000 episodes. I think it's May the 13th, episode number 1,000. Probably ought to get around to organising a party of some sort. That's for another day. What's for every day is the Racing app, which is where you can see every single one of our episodes listed chronologically. You can spin back through them very easily, and you can get the Racing app's own abridged version of each daily podcast as well, though sometimes their idea of what are my best bits and mine might differ somewhat, but that's fine. We don't mind creative differences. What's open to no doubt and what is for absolutely every day is the US racing service. You know I love American horse racing. If you are outside the United States and want the very best US horse racing service, and I'm talking cards, I'm talking past performances, I'm talking replays, all at one click, all very fast, all available to you, incredibly comprehensive, this is the place you have to go. For your US racing needs, if you're based outside the US, look no further than the Racing app. You're listening to Nick Luck Daily. This edition is brought to you by Timeform, the trusted source of racing data and analysis, by the Racehorse Owners Association, and by the Racing app, in partnership with FitzDares. Good morning, welcome to the show. Wednesday, March the 27th. Thanks to Tom for his hard work and excellent show yesterday. And as you know, we're now in Dubai. As you'd expect, the sun is shining, a little cooler than you'd normally imagine for this time of the year, which the horses won't mind at all. And we'll be giving you very full coverage of the run-up to the Dubai World Cup tomorrow and Friday. But today we thought it important to address many concerns surrounding relatively new betting company BetMGM, whose customer service was called into question a number of times during and after the Cheltenham Festival and ran rampage through social media. An awful lot of people calling for an awful lot of things, but in these circumstances you need a calm head and a bit of thorough research, which is where I would always call upon Lydia Hislop, who is with me this morning. Lydia, let's just go about telling everybody exactly the questions that you've been asking of BetMGM.
Absolutely. So, you know, you have to go through the process of that. So there were three particular incidents that I focused on and asked BetMGM to comment on. One was a complaint on social media from a customer who had deposited via PayPal and whose winning double on Langadan and an expected party was not initially settled. There was also some problems reported about Jehupu, the winner of the Stayers Hurdle, initially being settled for some customers as a loser rather than a winner. And then there was also a tweet that actually went, viral within the horse racing world about a complaint regarding the place terms offered on the Ultima Handicap, which the customer said had been missettled. The thing that really caught everybody's attention and meant that everybody focused on it was the explanation that the customer service representative gave, which seemed to focus on horses pulling up in the race rather than the number of runners that actually ran. Anyway, we can go into the details shortly, but those were the three main incidents that I focused on and asked BetMGM to comment on.
Okay, so you did quite a bit of digging over the weekend and subsequently, and ultimately you ended up with an email from BetMGM's UK director, Sam Behart, who said, "We are aware that we let some of our customers down and are disappointed that they did not have the best experience during the Cheltenham Festival. We have worked around the clock to rectify player issues and resolve the majority of customer queries in a timely manner. We've dealt with each concern with care and consideration. We experienced a technical error in the Stayers Hurdle, which was initially recorded as a void bet for some customers. This error was quickly rectified, with affected customers paid out correctly. We're aware of a complaint highlighted on social media regarding a customer who had deposited via PayPal and whose winning bet had not been settled. We can confirm that this matter, after investigation, has been resolved and the player has been paid. We're also aware of a complaint relating to the place terms offered on the Ultima Handicap. We can confirm we offered 5 places and not 6, as was widely reported on social media. The bet was settled correctly. Unfortunately, a customer services representative provided inaccurate information, which is, of course, regrettable, and for which we apologize. As a new sportsbook brand in the UK market, we remain committed to making continuous improvements and continuing to support UK horse racing through significant partnerships. And please let me know if I can be of any other assistance. So an element of contrition there, an apparent asking for understanding that the company is still finding its feet, a definite acceptance that customer service was significantly lacking, and one or two points of order that people wouldn't have realised from the flurry on social media over the weekend. Nicely dug.
I mean, the customer who was initially not paid out because they deposited via PayPal, there seems to be some terms and conditions that may mean that PayPal, you know, deposits via PayPal are not consonant with that. That is BetMGM's position. However, this was resolved. They also made the point that the technical error that caused Chupu to be missettled, voided, was a third-party service provider, and that service provider is Kambi. I know that we'll come back to that. And then they looked into the all of their offers on the Ultima, and we're confident that they had never offered six places and only the top five. However, the point remains that I was eventually able to get comment on this. The problem, and this applies not just to BetMGM, the problem for customers is that they first of all come up against customer service operators who are often not fully informed. And, you know, this it created a lot of humour, the Ultima explanation. But the problem comes back to training. And, you know, bookmakers need to have their customer-facing service providers fully trained. And that comes down to BetMGM's training. It's not the individual's fault. It is the fault of the training. And sometimes it can feel like it's another layer of difficulty, and this would apply across the board. This is not just a bookmaker issue. I think everybody recognises where they phone up. Well, if they can get hold of a human being, generally, you know, if you have a complaint, all phone numbers have been removed from all companies, and you have to go through tortuous processes in order to get to a human being. And, you know, the feeling that you're left with as a customer is that that is a level of deterrence, that even if you have a valid claim, that you might just get fed up with the amount of time and effort you have to go through with clearing those hurdles. So, I mean, across the board, the observation I would make to bookmakers, to betting companies, is that their customer service is not good enough, needs to be better, their training needs to be better, and it is not the level of service that betting customers deserve.
What about the alleged missettling of the Chupo bets?
Yeah, I think we can call it, you know, missettling now, because the facts have been established. So Kambi, who is a premium sports betting service provider. They sort of provide odds compiling, customer intelligence and risk management built on an in-house developed software platform. I'm reading from their website there. And they supply those services to BetMGM and other bookmakers. And we got an explanation from Gerard Starkey, who was their marketing and communications person. He said that, unfortunately, an error occurred in the settlement of a small number of bets on Chupu, one which was remedied quickly upon it becoming known. While we strive to minimise settlement errors and provide a fantastic customer experience, this particular settlement error occurred on the non-runner no bet market, the anti-post market, thereby only affecting bets placed on Chupu prior to declarations at the 48-hour stage. All other bets on Chupu, as well as bets on all other runners, were settled correctly, with the mistake impacting fewer than 5% of bets and turnover on that race across the Kambi network. The reason for the fault was simply human error, with Chupu on the non-runner no bet market erroneously voided, not settled as a loser, as stated below. I'd ask whether that was the case. Immediately upon this error being identified, impacted bets were resettled correctly. Following this unfortunate missettlement, which was the only one encountered during the festival, we have introduced robust remedial measures and have been cooperating with the Gambling Commission to provide an incident report. These are the areas where I think betting customers would really like the Gambling Commission you know, to act, to take more interest in the everyday experience of betting customers. I was reminded that sometime, I think just before the pandemic, there was some talk from the Gambling Commission about creating a recreational gamblers panel. As far as I'm aware, this hasn't been done. Instead, we've had a consumer voice research program. But that seems to me to be heavily weighted towards those gamblers who are or might be at risk. And the Gambling Commission are not hearing from the overwhelming number of people who bet without a problem day in, day out, and experience these kinds of things. And, you know, this is just one example of the kind of thing that regular bettors will say that they encounter all the time. I also think there's an issue here for racing, for horse racing to take notice, because on the 8th of March, Cheltenham Racecourse and the Jockey Club announced that BetMGM was the new sponsor of the County Hurdle. They said that they'll be an official betting partner of the Jockey Club and have its name attached to a number of flagship races and race days at Jockey Club racecourses. They included the Holden Gold Cup at Exeter and the Elite Hurdle at Wincanton. And the point I've repeatedly made on this podcast and delivered directly to racing's leaders, such as those who head major racecourse groups, that this kind of partnership is a form of endorsement. And therefore, racing and the Jockey Club in this case should be interested in the customer experience that racing fans are having and should be holding their commercial partners, their official betting partners, to a high standard. They should be interested in complaints like this. They should be interested in horse racing fans' customer experience, and they should be asking questions when things like this happen. And, you know, I would observe that the horse racing industry called on punters to support it by joining their petition to Parliament, which was started by Nevin Truesdale, the chief executive of the Jockey Club. Well, you know, there is a quid pro quo about that. You know, horse racing needs to be interested in the experience of its racing fans when they're betting every day, and not just ask them to turn up when it's in their own perceived interests. And, you know, there needs to be some kind of reciprocity, which I'm afraid at this point appears to me to be lacking.
And it's not just BetMGM, is it? And people will no doubt be saying, hang on a minute, you do work for bookmakers, you take advertising from bookmakers. This is a customer service issue that runs right across the board. And I don't think there's barely a single firm that's immune.
I'd be astonished if they were. I mean, I've certainly had experiences myself that have been extraordinary. I mean, I do think that the explanation given for the Ultima thing it is extraordinary. That's one of the reasons why it went viral, is because it was so ridiculous. But as we say, you know, BetMGM have actually clarified that, so it's not as straightforward as everybody thinks.
You do wonder whether there was a bit of mischief making there, don't you? Whether somebody thought, right, let's test their processes here and see whether if we say that it was a first six payout and not a first five payout.
Well, I mean, it could have been an honest mistake. If you're having a lot of bets, you know, there are a lot of different offers. You know, it's equally possible that it could be an honest mistake.
It's by the by, isn't it? I mean, the response is a terrible one. Yeah, and I suppose, actually, come to think of it, that there is a third possibility that the customer thought that the place terms were first six because it was advertised somewhere else, so it was a, you know, third party.
It is, but it's not. I mean, it's the fact that, I mean, and when I first saw it, I thought, is that a spoof? And then the fact that you have to think, well, no, that is possible. What does that tell the bookmaking industry about their customer service? If people are looking at that and thinking, okay, that is something that could happen, and as it turns out, did happen, what does that say about the level of customer service that bettors are getting? I mean, that is shocking, really, isn't it? And if I was part of that industry, I'd be embarrassed.
Yesterday in London, the training career of Gary Sanderson came to an end, certainly temporarily, as he was disqualified for 2 years by the Independent Disciplinary Panel. That means he's not allowed on any BHA licensed premises, and he has to relinquish his trainer's license. Peter Scargill, the deputy industry editor for the Racing Post, was present through what can only be described as a pretty bizarre and sometimes quite upsetting case. Peter, just set out the charges against Gary Sanderson.
Sure. Hi, Nick. Yes, I've never sat in anything quite like the last 2 days' hearing. So last summer, Mr. Sanderson was found guilty of 9 charges of animal cruelty and neglect against 5 horses in his care. They weren't in a licensed property at the time. They were on an unlicensed area of land, but he was a licensed trainer at the time of the offences. So the hearing over the last 2 days was to determine whether those offences were a breach of the rules of racing. He was charged under Rule J26, which is a person must not be convicted of a criminal offence that relates to horse racing. So it was determined that his offences were related to horse racing, as he was a licensed trainer and they were thoroughbreds. And yes, he ended up with a 2-year penalty after the panel had heard from him and from Charlotte Davison representing the BHA. But like I said, it was unlike anything I've ever sat in, and I've been at the racing place for quite a long time now.
Well, in part because Gary Sanderson chose to defend himself, which is always going to make for quite an unusual hearing. Just describe to me some of the more passionate exchanges that took place.
Sure. I mean, you know, it's understandable that anyone who is representing themselves, and Mr. Sanderson, you know, he's lived and breathed this for the last 5 years, so, you know, he feels he knows his case better than anybody else. And I say it's understandable that the sort of the legal aspects and the procedural aspects he wouldn't necessarily understand, you know, calling everyone by their first name and that sort of thing. But the problem is that he would get increasingly angry at being questioned and at being cross-examined to various points where he would sort of go off the handle and going down lines of conspiracy theories. He's saying he was fitted up by a vet, that you know, his situation is akin to what's happened to the people involved in the Horizon scandal at the post office. There was a period his wife sort of came in and out. It was held over Zoom. His wife came in and out of the hearing, and she'd be chipping in, and he would sort of be, you know, shouting at her to come and sort of address the panel. There was a period when they were shown some photos. We saw some photos of the horses of very badly overgrown feet, sort of splayed and split. And he claimed that he had never, you know, those photos weren't his horses. It's the first time he'd ever said they weren't his horses. He was claiming they were different horses that the RSPCA had taken the photos of. You know, it was incoherent at times. And as I say, I do appreciate that Mr. Sanderson was very passionate about his position, but, you know, he refuses to accept he's done anything wrong. He just denied it throughout, and he didn't help his cause whatsoever.
So if you're going to take a position that's that entrenched, if you get found against, obviously that's not going to help you when it comes to a penalty.
Well, exactly. You know, the panel chair, and I have to say, the independent disciplinary panel of the BHA don't always get credit they deserve, and sometimes the process isn't, you know, what people would want it to be. I know that in the George Gently Dan Skelton case, many people don't feel that should have been fast-tracked, but Fiona Horlick, KC, who chaired the panel, and Austin Allison and Dr. Judith Finley, who were on the panel, were excellent. They understood that Mr. Sanderson didn't necessarily get what was going on, and helped him as best they could throughout the process to try and make, you know, try and keep him on the straight and narrow. But say, even though he accepted that the hearing wasn't a rehearing of his criminal charges, that he had been found guilty, you know, at every single opportunity he would say, you know, I'm innocent, I've not done anything wrong, those horses look fine, everyone says they look fine, everyone supports me. And you know, it was incoherent. He didn't help his cause. He would go off and getting extremely angry, and we'd have to have breaks while he calmed down. You know, it was bizarre. Honestly, it was bizarre. And I say it came from a position of extreme passion, but the problem is that, you know, he has been found guilty in court. And those, look, I've seen horses worse than those horses. You know, I was involved in the Camille Mardy case in Newmarket many years ago, but those horses didn't look great. And, you know, his denial of that was, as Charlotte Davison said, it's startling, really.
Couple of questions. Did he have supporting witnesses from within the industry?
No, he sought to get some people to testify for him, but he was unable to. He supplied some character references that had been used for the magistrate's case, but obviously the BHA pointed out that those were delivered before the fact, so they might not necessarily be relevant now. So no, it was only him representing his case, and say his wife would sort of appear at certain points. At one point, she said that he lives and breathes horses; he never leaves the farm. I mean, you know, during the case, he'd been sitting up waiting for mares to foal. He'd been up waiting for, I think he's got 5 mares to foal, and so he's doing that all night, and then he was coming straight in to do this. So you know he's clearly someone who is passionate about horses, but it was him versus the BHA, for want of a better description.
All right, and do you think he'll appeal?
His initial reaction was that he would, i.e. Before they gave the judgment, he sort of rather flippantly said, look, send me through the appeal form. Because, you know, like I said, he is completely convinced he's done nothing wrong. My understanding is that there might be quite a high deposit required for an appeal, which might make things difficult, because obviously he has lost lots of clients through this process. The horses that he still has on the premises are mostly supported by his wife's job as a hairdresser. And he says it's very difficult to sell any of the stock he has because of the market conditions. So whether he's in a position to financially appeal, I don't know. But, anything could happen, because he is so entrenched in his position. He is so convinced he's done nothing wrong, that it wouldn't surprise me if he gave good thought to it. It might just be financially he's unable to do so.
My thanks to Peter Scargill, the deputy industry editor of the Racing Post, for giving us that summary of the Gary Sanderson case. I have spoken to Gary Sanderson this morning, Lydia, and he is clearly an extremely aggrieved man. It as was the case, what Pete was describing there, Gary's thoughts were not necessarily well marshalled, but there were a lot of them, and he clearly feels that he is the victim in this case. I asked him whether he would appeal. He said he'd need in the region of £20,000 to appeal, which he didn't have. So he'd either have to have someone give him the money or lend him the money. And if he were to appeal, I suspect it would be futile to do so without legal representation, which might not have helped his cause here. Either which way, it was interesting to hear Pete's thoughts on the way that this case was conducted, which was clearly done with a degree of empathy and fairness.
Well, absolutely, and it was good to hear that process took account of Gary Sanderson representing himself, because I often have held concerns, and I think other journalists who've watched proceedings have, that when somebody is representing themselves, that they are outgunned on a sort of legal understanding, and it is then beholden on the panel, the independent disciplinary panel, to take account of that. And I'm pleased to hear from Pete that did take place. It was chaired by Fiona Horlick KC, who is a practicing barrister across a range of professional disciplines, including regulatory, health and safety, and crime. And the two people who flanked her were Austin Allison, who's a retired senior legal advisor and has experience as an arbitrator and mediator, and Dr. Judith Findlay, who is a veterinary surgeon recognised by the Royal College of Veterinary Service Surgeons and across Europe as a specialist in equine surgery. So it sounds like a fitting panel to be hearing that case, but it was not a rehearing. The fact of what happened to Gary Sanderson, that he was given in magistrate's court a 200-hour community order and an £80 fine, that fact is what drove the case. And it is under Rule J26, a person not be convicted of any criminal offence in connection with horse racing in any jurisdiction. Well, he was convicted for 9 offences contrary to the Animal Welfare Act of 2006. What interests me is the amount of his disqualification, or the length of his disqualification from as regards horse racing. The spread available was between 6 months and 10 years, and the entry point was 1 year. So the panel, in effect, doubled that. And I suppose I would ask, and I stress that I have not heard this case firsthand. I am leaning on the York Press court report for during Mr. Sanderson's lengthy trial. Witnesses described how the RSPCA found horses in his care with lice and worm infestations, poor dental care, overgrown hooves, poor bodily condition, and living without proper feed. They also found that he had failed to get veterinary treatment for a wounded horse and one in poor physical condition, didn't protect horses from pain and suffering, and that one horse had been able to get into a dilapidated farm building where it could be harmed. Now, I know that Mr. Sanderson has some disagreements with some of the aspects of that. But nonetheless, that is the evidence that British horse racing has before it. And I ask in that context, is 2 years sufficient? Does that sound sufficient?
It makes me think, though I don't know this, it makes me think that there were certain elements of Mr. Sanderson's dissatisfaction with the procedure that led to his prosecution by the RSPCA that I'm not saying the BHA had sympathy with, but that they listened to and took stock of.
Well, it's the independent panel, isn't it? And it may have been.
Sorry, apologies. Yeah,
the British Horse Racing Authority might have done that. But I mean, we weren't there. Pete was, and we haven't got the reasons. I'm only asking that question at this point, and I'm not going to be taking it any further than merely asking that question, because we're going to get the reasons for the judgment from Fiona Horlick KC, and that is when I think we can go into this in more detail. But if we look at recent similar measures meted out against people who have had charges of neglect and cruelty found to have been guilty of that in Ireland recently. There's been a number of cases. And again, the feeling you've been left with is horse racing's response to that sufficient? And the penalties that have been imposed, does that say that we as a sport do not tolerate such behaviour in any kind of way? And I'm, as I say, at this stage, I'm merely asking the question because it worries me that it doesn't look like we take it seriously enough.
I think the reasons may give some sort of answer to that, but
I am making a more general point, Nick. I'm not. Yeah. I'm broadening it out to a wider question for Britain and for Ireland.
It's a timely general point as well, Lydia, because where were you and I on Monday evening?
Yes, we were. World Horse Welfare had a dinner in the Jockey Club rooms in Newmarket, where they asked a number of people to give up their time for the evening to join them in discussion about where horse racing in Britain stands in terms of welfare and the perception of how it treats the horse and where British racing sits in regarding changing feelings and thoughts within society. This is obviously something that we have discussed many times, and all of this can be boiled down to the sport's social license.
All right. I spoke with the World Horse Welfare's chief executive, Rowley Owers, and asked him about the purpose of the evening and what he felt could be achieved.
Nick, thank you very much. I mean, we were delighted with this evening's discussion. I mean, very much the aim was for us to articulate what World Horse Welfare's involvement is in sport, and we are the only equine welfare charity globally to support the responsible use of horses in sport, but also for us to listen, and it's a process that we have been doing over the last year, to speak to racing's leaders, and obviously that's a broad number of groups and individuals, and to understand more about what they see as the priorities. Because for us, this whole concept of social license, public acceptance of horse sport and horse racing is so important, and it needs to be handled sensitively, and it needs to be greater awareness across horse racing but also horse sport about what that means in practice. And it was really interesting to hear those ideas tonight.
So from tonight, what do you think are the key areas of conversation that the sport needs to have?
I think there needs to be a greater awareness around the challenges that the sport faces. There was a lot of talk tonight about trying to talk about the positives. And I think we absolutely would agree with that, that there is so much good practice that goes on. British Racing has the Horse Welfare Board, and a lot of people here tonight could articulate clear examples of where there is so much good. But we know that the public and those within the horse world have concerns. Issues around traceability, issues around injury and fatality, issues around aftercare. And so there is so much more that can be done in all of these areas to provide those authentic messages that people understand, that they know that this is not a risk-free sport, but they want to know what horse sport is doing to reduce those risks and increase the benefits to horses. And I think for us tonight, this was the start of a conversation. You know, this is the beginning of a journey and certainly not a destination.
Yeah, we've heard for as long as I can remember watching racing on television, right from, you know, the very earliest memories, advocates for the sport, trainers, breeders, jockeys, owners, talking about how well horses are looked after. The one thing for me that came out of tonight was that you and Jess, your colleague, were both saying, do you know what? That's the minimum the public expects. They're not surprised by that. It's the minimum they expect.
Absolutely. And I think there is, absolutely, we believe that. The fact that, you know, horses don't want to be treated like kings and queens. They want to be treated like horses. As we heard from people tonight, you know, even when horses are big horses, that's not risk-free either. But absolutely, it's these authentic messages really speaking to people's values. And that's what we had a webinar in January where we had the vice president of McDonald's speaking about what other industries have done, whose social license has been put under the pressure. And what comes out time and time again is trust and transparency. You're not trying to win an argument here. You're trying to listen and understand what people's concerns are, and then being able to change where you need to make changes, but also then be able to speak to those concerns.
Rolio is their chief executive of World Horse Welfare. Well, it was either a case of the great and the good of horse racing, or the devil could cast his net. I'm not sure which. But anyway, lots of people who were familiar names and leaders in the sport were assembled to listen and exchange ideas. Did you think it was a valuable exercise?
Yes, I did. I think it's right that horse racing as a sport asks itself some challenging questions. There's always improvements to be made. If we look 20 years ago, there are things that will have been done in horse racing, in sport, in life, that are no longer deemed to be things that people, practices or attitudes that people wish to continue or to hold. Life always evolves and changes, and therefore it is beholden on the sport and individuals within the sport to challenge themselves and ask on an ethical basis whether they feel that all of the behaviours all of the time are conforming to the high standards that the sport should hold itself to. Now, obviously, as we're human beings, all of the behaviours all of the time is impossible, as it would be in any walk of life, because humans are humans. But asking yourself that question and challenging yourself to hold yourself to that high bar is the important part.
Now, rather back to where we started, Lydia, the major betting companies, Flutter, the parent company, amongst others, of Skybet, Paddy Power, Betfair, FanDuel, and 888 William Hill, reporting growth and good results, but also a good Cheltenham Festival, amongst other things, which might surprise a few people, given how many short price favourites went in.
Yeah, so that's a piece by Bill Barber in the Racing Post. So this is an analysis of what they had experienced during the Cheltenham Festival. I was taken by the thought about how much their profits had been helped by overseas expansion on both counts. They're both currently London listed. You mentioned that FanDuel is particularly successful for Flutter. And there's been some speculation I've been hearing and reading amongst mainstream financial journalists about whether Flutter will shift the company's primary listing from the London Stock Exchange to New York, and their shareholders will decide at the start of May on whether to do that. It's as I understand it, Dublin-based Flutter wants to make the switch because FanDuel provides the largest share of its revenues, and US markets enable access to much deeper capital pools. And I am reading from Harry Wise's article on This Is Money here. But as I said, I also heard it on the radio from other financial journalists. Obviously, this would be further damage to London's reputation as a financial centre, which we've been seeing particularly post-Brexit. But it would also be interesting in terms of those major bookmakers' customer emphasis. And, you know, as a sort of British customers, you worry that as regulation enables expansion in America almost on a state-by-state basis, that sudden expansion of new potential customers will become the overwhelming focus. You know, the problems that are across the British gambling scene, which you know, racing is wrestling with, which the Gambling Commission and the Parliament is wrestling with, that actually you know, the British landscape is something of is rather irksome as compared with the literal brave new world of America.
Should we talk about the Grand National? This might be a sobering thought for people as well. Of the 34 horses that are now above the cut, 10 Mullins, 10 Elliott, 8 Irish Others, 6 UK. So this debate that was starting to really rage after Cheltenham is just going to continue to rage into Aintree, isn't it? And also the question about, without wishing to echo the Dr. Newland article, the question about whether the trainer should be limited to how many horses they run in various races. And this of course was the first suggestion that was floated by the BHA.
So last December, that is when the British Horse Racing Authority wrote to a number of stakeholders to say that they were contemplating limiting the number of horses any trainer could run in major handicaps. And then the following month, after gathering all that feedback, they decided to, in effect, shelve it. But this was kept under review. And they did specifically say that they would be looking at what happens in this year's National. So I think there will be some scrutiny of whether the perception is that the National becomes more of a turnoff for racing fans, and also more casual sports fans who are interested by the Grand National, when one or two stables dominate the race so greatly. So I would imagine if we end up with that kind of look to the final field, then this topic will certainly come up again.
Now, John Dance's horses are off to the sales. They're off to Tattersalls in May as part of the Guineas sale. Lydia, there are a lot of them, and they will no doubt generate a lot of interest. What creditors will be pleased with is that there is more money going to be going back into the coffers in order to pay them out.
Yeah, and you've covered the story previously. Lots of disgruntled creditors. There's more than 50 lots in the 2024 Tattersalls Breeze Up and Horses in Training sale. The catalogue is accessible online, and notably, it includes the first foal of Lawrence, John Dance's celebrated 6 times Group 1 winner. So it's all of those horses that were owned by Coverdale Stud or our Titanian Racing Club. And just a reminder that the allegation that John Dance faces is that he perpetrated one of the largest frauds perpetrated by an FCA-regulated individual at an authorised firm. So that case continues, and this is the latest development from a horse racing angle.
My understanding is that it is John Dance's representatives that have instructed the sale, though presumably with the approval of the BHA, and that the FCA, I am told, have approved this sale. Yeah, I should think so too, really. Time for the weekly review from the Point to Point scene, brought to you by Thoroughbid's Point to Rules bonus, which dangles a £5,000 carrot for any point sold through Thoroughbid that goes on to win on debut under rules. Joining me to discuss all things point to pointing this week, Ben Atkins from the Pointing Pointers podcast. Easy for you to say, Ben. What news shall we start with?
Well, plenty's been going on, Nick, as always. Never a dull moment in this beautiful corner of British racing. But Tom Ellis has left the pointing ranks as a trainer and handed over the reins to incredibly successful rider Gina, his wife. Gina was training her first at the weekend just gone, and had a treble. So great to see her getting underway. As I said, Tom's moving into training under rules, and his first runner, as is well published, will be the in the Grand National. But he's had a barn of 18 horses licensed to take under rules for next season, and everyone in Poynting wishes him all the best.
Yeah, and given his excellent connections, it would be a big surprise if he didn't make a pretty instant impact under rules. It was a weekend for multiple winners, not just Gina Andrews / Ellis with a treble as a trainer, but several others who were multiply successful.
Yeah, interestingly, it's not just the under rules where a clutch of trainers are dominating, but yeah, it isn't always the case in Poynting. And this weekend, Josh Newman had six winners, rode four of them, two at Cotley, three at Kilworthy, and had one at Garthorpe too, which puts him in the top five in the men's championship as a jockey, and also put him with 14 winners for the leading trainer of 15 or more horses, just two behind Max Comley. So they're going great guns, you know, partner of Kaylee Woollacott, and they're having a really, really good time of things. And also Dean Summersby had four winners, if you include a dead heat down there in deepest, darkest Devon at Kilworthy. So, yeah, a weekend of multiples, like you say.
Is there a challenge to Gina Andrews' own crown in the Ladies' Championship?
Well, it's very early to make that call, Nick, but I don't think you could be accused of being too dramatic. Izzy Marshall is definitely snapping away at her heels, and you know, they're great friends, and she's been a great mentor to Izzy. So it's really adds a nice twist to the remainder of the season. Look, Gina's had a slow start by her own admission, but they've got plenty of darts to throw at the board. So it'll be a bit of interest for those watching on.
Izzy Marshall riding for the Alan Hill team. She's married to Alan's son, Joe, isn't she?
They're engaged, yeah, I believe. A technicality. But yeah, it's soon to be wed this summer, indeed.
Yeah, apologies for jumping the gun there, Izzy and Joe. Rules winners of note that we need to mention who've come from the point-to-point field.
Yeah, every week that goes by, Nick, there's a clutch of horses, sometimes more notable than others. You know, we've had four or five since we last spoke, but perhaps the most notable being Doyen Quest, who is helping the Skeletons in their quest for the trainer's title, winning for them last week. Won his maiden for Tom Weston at Maysmore in 2022, and has won three for the Skeletons thus far. As I say, there is a continuing steady stream of horses that are winning on the British pointing field and going on to win under rules.
That's quite encouraging, as is the entry for the Fox Hunters at Aintree. I mean, the Cheltenham equivalent was a bit dismal in terms of the numerical entry, and indeed the British numerical entry, even though there was a British winner. Sine Nomine announced this week that he'll run in the Scottish National for Fiona Needham. The Aintree Fox Hunter entries look by contrast quite strong.
Yeah, absolutely. And it looks a very open race this time around. You know, I've chatted through it with a few people already, and there's no standout contenders, you know, but it's great to see that there is a strong entry from this side of the pond. I think, Nick, it's too early to say, because we just don't know what the ground's going to do. You know, Spyglass Hill, we know, wins when it's heavy, and he's a really interesting runner, trained by Reagan Palace, who's had one spin so far in the Walrus and won, and he comes straight here. If it's heavy, I'd be really interested in him. And then you've got horses like T Clipper and Cat Royale, who will need it to be on the better side of things, and could cause a massive upset if the ground goes their way. So I think it's going to be very ground dependent, as is many things at the moment.
Okay, we're going to have a new CEO of Point to Point Racing. Peter Wright is leaving, and the CEO is down to the last two. Who are the two? Do we know?
No, I've been kept in the dark for want of tr- not
Come
for
on,
want
you,
of trying.
You must have a good idea.
I've literally just got off the phone to Charlie Post, who's on the panel, and I didn't ask him directly because I wouldn't put him in that position. But look, he said that they've been really excited with the amount of people that have applied, and they're really kind of interested to see what happens with the last two. I think whatever happens, it looked at one stage to be quite concerning that no one was going to step up to fill some very big boots. I think universally, it's pretty much accepted that Peter's done a phenomenal job in some tricky times, and whoever comes in has got a job on their hands to follow him. But look, Charlie said that they're they're down to the last two, and whoever it's going to be is going to be interesting and exciting to go forward with.
All right, where can you go racing this weekend? Easter weekend is huge.
Yeah, exactly. So it's always a big weekend for people to go pointing. Hopefully the sun continues to shine. On Friday, the racing at Higham in Suffolk, where me and Sam will be. On Saturday, Chilfrum, Kimball and Sandon. Sunday, Maysmore in Gloucestershire and Cherrybrook in Devon. And on Monday, there's lots of racing on. So you can go to Lidstep in Wales, Paxford in Gloucestershire, Lockinge in Oxfordshire, Thorpe Lodge, which is close to Nottingham, or Cofflestone in Somerset. And you really are sport for choice, Nick. As I've said before, it's a fantastic child-friendly, dog-friendly, cost-effective family day out, relaxed. You can have a bet in cash or card. You can have a decent, sensibly priced pint. Look, there's so many reasons why you should get pointing this weekend. And as I say, not least to come and see me and Sam Davies Thomas at Higham. So hope to see some of you there and pointing this weekend wherever you choose to go.
All right, and when's the next Thoroughbred sale?
It's on the 30th of April, Nick. And so we will, of course, keep you across all details for entries and the sale itself on this section in future weeks.
Ben Atkins there. Now, with the Dubai World Cup just days away, we once again join Laura King as she profiles those who've made racing in Dubai.
Sam Shinsky was just 29 years old when he took on the role of senior steward for the Emirates Racing Authority, which governs the sport in Dubai and across the UAE. Now nearly 10 years in, he's approaching another Dubai World Cup in trademark unflappable style. Not brought up in racing, his involvement comes from a love of the sport.
My brother got into racing, that's how I originally got into it. He's a farrier, worked for some prominent trainers back home, but I only really got into racing after I left school. I obviously have always loved sports, and you know, racing, as soon as I sort of started following racing, you start watching it on a Saturday, then a Sunday, then Wednesdays, and next thing you know, you're following it every day of the week. So I think a jockey once described it as being part of the mob. Once you're in it, you can't get out of it.
Some jockeys might disagree, but Sam is well-liked across the UAE's tight-knit industry, where his role extends to licensing, integrity and arranging sales, as well as the usual suspensions and warnings.
I think what it comes down to is, you know, if you just do your job, do it fairly, the people in the industry, and there's a lot of great people in the industry, they respect you for that, and they understand that you're doing your role, and the ones that don't, well, I think they're just not going to like anyone at the end of the day. But, you know, there was a saying that I once heard, and I think it is very true, that sometimes innocent people get penalised to ensure that integrity is maintained. And what I mean by that is rule breaches will happen. It may be by accident, but to keep the integrity, they have to unfortunately be penalized. So as long as you go through the proper processes and you explain it, most reasonable people will understand why you've made the decision that you have.
Sam is the first to admit that integrity is one of the hardest parts of the job, but the UAE has a rigorous testing program.
The thing about testing is, you know, as I think you'll see, not just in racing, I think it goes in any sport, that, you know, the regulator is always trying to catch up. However, you can try and ensure certain things to make sure that the rules are followed. And, you know, what we do with any horse that's coming into the country, they'll get a sample taken from them when they arrive, obviously make sure that there's no banned substances in their system, but also it's a good starting point if there is any issue with the horse with a sample later on, specifically from the main race. And you can sort of go back and see what was in the sample from when they first arrived. But, you know, we're quite lucky here in that we have the only accredited racing laboratory in the Middle East, and we have had now for some time. So we use that quite extensively, and the result of that is we test probably too much. and that part of that is we want to show people that we do test aggressively. And that, you know, our racing can be or is as clean and fair as possible. So, you know, we're talking about every horse that steps foot at Maidan on Saturday week. I think that's on the 30th of March. We'll have a sample taken from it. Some horses will be tested twice. You know, horses that finish first, second, third will get tested. Any horse that performs poorly, we'll test them. There'll be a range of blood and urine samples that will get sent to the laboratory if there's any issue. With that, we usually get it confirmed at what we think are the leading laboratories around the world in either Hong Kong or France. So there's a fair process. And on top of that, most horses that are here are stabled in quarantine. Security cameras. Horses can only be treated by the equine hospital vets. Everything's documented. So there's a fair bit of checks and balances put in place to make sure that the rules are followed. We're pretty confident that going into the race meeting that all horses that are running are going to be drug-free.
Being a steward isn't for everyone. So what are the good parts of the job?
I do love racing, so it doesn't feel like you're necessarily always working. It's harder now, but you have a family and all that. You feel the pressures, but I still enjoy it. The World Cup is an amazing meeting. I still think having worked, I worked three Melbourne Cups, I've done Golden Slipper, I've done other prominent races back in Australia. I don't think there's any meeting for me that rivals World Cup Day, because every race, there's something that's exciting about it. Where the other meetings, you have undercards and some of the races, like even Melbourne Cup Day, a lot of the races that are run are just there to fill up the time, where World Cup Day, every race is exciting and you see some of the best horses around the world competing. And, you know, like the likes of Equinox, Arrogate. I think the horse that stands out for me was Just Away when I first got here. He was super impressive. So being able to see those horses live win, that's the perk of the job.
You get the impression that whatever happens, Sam Shinsky will take it in his stride.
Okay, thank you to Laura and to all my guests today. Lydia is still with me. Now, Good Friday's approaching, the Easter weekend's approaching, bit of Dubai into the mix as well. Where are we going for the tip, I wonder?
Well, I'm heading to Newcastle, quite literally, and also via the medium of this podcast, because my husband Steve and I are going up to watch Penzance, who's the horse that I've mentioned to podcast listeners before, is one of the two that we have a small share in, trained by Mick Appleby. Alistair Rawlinson obviously rides, and this horse has won his last four starts, and he is running in the 4.10 on Good Friday, which is the Bet UK All-Weather Easter Classic Middle Distance Handicap. He's been drawn in three, which is pretty much perfect, and I think he's still very progressive. Now, it's a very competitive race. There's a French raider in Hooking. There's a 108 rated horse from Adrian Murray called Elegant Man. Tamusius Fox was obviously a very comfortable winner at Kempton last time. So, and there's horses that Penzance has run into previously, such as Stormcatcher and To Catch a Thief, who was a favourite to beat him earlier when they last met and ran inexplicably badly. That horse has dangerously just snuck in right at the bottom for William Haggis. But we all are very hopeful that Penzance will be able to step up again. He certainly won a little bit snugly at Lingfield last time, despite not handling the track as well as he does Newcastle.
Splendid. All the best to you. All the news from Dubai tomorrow and Friday. We'll be out and about chatting to plenty of connections on what it promises to be a wonderful, wonderful night's racing on Saturday. And that's it for the moment. That was Wednesday, March the 27th.
You've been listening to Nick Luck Daily, brought to you by Timeform, the trusted source of racing data and analysis, by the Racehorse Owners Association, and by the Racing App in partnership with FitStairs.